Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that little insight into our guest today. On the podcast, we had Bob Asim. He is a mid-30-year-old Malaysian professional who has worked at various large medical organisations, bringing products to market and into hospitals and GP surgeries such as breast cancer and diabetes medications. He is also one of the nicest people that I think I've ever met. He just has some amazing philosophies on life that have really stuck with me, and I hope that they'll stick with you as well. I think it's very easy to overlook some people that don't blow their own horn and just go about their lives being nice people. But when you do some deep analysis, some of these people are just friggin' geniuses. And I really believe there's a lot we can learn from people who are just generally very nice. So I have a specific example from a time with Bob that even at the time when I was there, I didn't actually realize what a genius he was being. And I thought maybe he was just being a bit odd or stupid and didn't really think into it. But in hindsight now, I see how amazing his decisions were. And I'll explain the process. So Bob has this new house in Malaysia, and we met him in Thailand, and he invited us to come and stay with him. So me and my friend went to stay, and after a few weeks, one day we were, I think my friend was boiling some beans to make some veggie burgers. And they were taking ages, so sometimes he'd stir them, I'd stir them, or whatever. And later that day, we then went out to meet Bob for dinner and stuff. And then we come back, and turns out his nice new kitchen, white, was smelling horrendously of a mix of burnt hair and burnt plastic. And we'd left the beans on the hob, and it was awful. Like, this weird, disgusting black liquid had just gone all over, like, his kitchen surface and down, like, the sides of his cupboards and underneath the cupboards where you couldn't even get to. And, it was terrible. And the hob was all burnt. And the saucepan that we used was just looked like disgusting and ruined. And the beans were like, whoa. And, yeah, any normal human being would have walked into their nice new kitchen and been like, guys, what the... Jesus Christ, oh my God, oh my God, I can't believe this, and gone pretty mental, and been like, whoa, we have to sort this out, and spent the rest of that evening dealing with the problem. But Bob, who was, it was kind of late, and he had work the next morning, and he was just like, oh well, I'm sure you guys can fix it, doesn't matter, and didn't shout at all. Like, I also have this protein shake I have to have. This is annoying. My trainer makes me have this protein shake each night. Oh, well. So he has his protein shake and just goes to bed without shouting at all. And me and my friend are like, what the fuck? Oh, my God. I can't believe you bloody left those beans on. What the fuck? Why is it my fault? It's your fault. What? It's not my fault. And then we just shouted a lot. And then we fixed the problem and cleaned it. And we're like, what? You're messing it up. You're not doing it right. Oh, you're making it worse. Oh, you're making it worse. Oh, we're never going to fix this. And like after 2 or 3 hours, we eventually clean it and it looks fine. The saucepan took a bit longer. It took like maybe the whole of the next day to fix, but we still fixed that as well. And because we're nice, we went and bought like a cool blender and ice and fruit and stuff. So Bob is now able to make cool iced fruit protein smoothies at nighttime, and they were really delicious. And so we present this to Bob, and he's like, oh, this is amazing. Thanks, guys. And that's it. It's kind of the end of the story. We're all very happy. And at the time, I'm like, wow, it's just a bit weird that Bob didn't really get that pissed off. And what's wrong with Bob? But then in hindsight, that's amazing. He saved himself many hours of frustration and just running around his kitchen, going mental and being pissed off, which is just not that much fun for anyone to do, and also would have made him much later to bed and had a shit time at work the next day, and maybe would have been pissed off at other people and potentially would have been less friends with us because he would have spent so much time shouting at us. And that's like amazing when you think about it. He just sidestepped a whole bunch of shit that he just didn't need in his life, and I'm pretty sure any normal human being would have been like, crap, because I certainly would have. But now I'm going to try and be more like Bob, and hopefully you can too. And so, listening to the podcast, we can maybe learn some other insights from him of how to be nice people. Anyway, the interview I think is really great, and Bob's just one of the kindest people on the planet. It takes a bit of a while to warm up, but he really gives some tremendous advice on how to live a content and happy life, and how to find purpose in your life, and how to help yourself by helping others, along with just some great quotes. So, on that note, enjoy.
Cool. So, you were always interested in healthcare when you were younger?
The interesting thing is, no, I was never really interested in biology, but one of the teacher when I was form four, there was, I don't know what is it in UK, but he sort of like changed me in the sense that he helped me, he gave me like tuition for free and to improve my biology. Like my biology was like failed all year long, and then because of him, I started to pass biology. And then I started to get interested. You know, I'm always a curious boy, like since young, you know, I always ask myself, like, why am I here on earth? What's my purpose and things like that. So I thought biology would be a good answer to that. That's why I went on to do biology in my undergrad. I did biotechnology. So that sort of like answered a lot of questions about, you know, life itself and things like that.
So why are you here?
I'm still finding out. But I mean, it's a complicated question. I never really wanted to go into healthcare, like, because if I would, I would have go for biomedical.
Yeah,
I went for biotechnology. So, and I didn't really want to do so much to help human, because I kind of think that human destroy the earth.
Yeah,
like I wanted more on to help the animals and things like that. But eventually, I don't know how, but I sort of discovered my passion in helping people, like especially those patients who really need medications and things like that. And and it just come naturally. Like,
So you think it came naturally? Was there any specific moments when you sort of met someone or you saw someone like, crap, if only I could like get them better value healthcare?
I remember when I was launching this product in Malaysia, when you take care of products that are treating cancer, sometimes you get really emotional because the patients don't live long, even with the advanced research and drugs that we have today. And I still remember I was watching one video of a patient who is on that drug, and she was talking about, she was trying to encourage the staff, and she said that each and every one of us play a role in what we do, you know, whether it's someone who does research, with someone who's selling the drugs, someone who's delivering the drugs and things like that. So she's bold because, you know, her hairs are gone, but and she said that sometimes you can feel so dull at your work, but just remember that what you do matters, because there's always a mother like me. Her life changed because everyone plays their role. And because of that drug, she was able to see her daughter grow up and things. And I think those are the things that keep me going.
Like,
you know, you see patients who have a chance to attend the kids' graduation or see the children growing and things like that.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's kind of hard when you don't feel like you're the ones who just invented the drug. But actually doing anything to help it go to more people is important.
Yeah, but you know, we always have a role to play. I may not be the one who invented the drugs, but there's other things that I do, like I launch the drugs here and make sure that it is at an affordable price that the patients can have access to and things like that. So I think every little thing plays a role. Mm. But most of the time when you invented a product, it's just the first step.
Yeah.
And how it got to the market, how the, you know, how the people adopt the product. Yeah, it's really important. Like you make app and everything.
Mm.
Once you created an app, it's just the first step. So everyone plays a role.
Nice. Yeah, when I was interviewing, it was like the boss of like a really big business, but it's like I work with people thoroughly. They're all really just as important as I am. Like even the cleaners, like if the guy who cleans the toilet doesn't come in tomorrow, within a few days, we've got chaos in the office. If I don't come in tomorrow, like, everything's going to be fine for, like, a few weeks. Realistically, like, this guy that cleans the toilets is just as important as me. That's a good way to think about it.
It's true. I have, like, cleaner comes into my room every day, and I make sure that I acknowledge her, I thank her, because she makes sure that my, you know, my dustbin is empty, it's clean, my room doesn't smell.
Yeah.
Everyone plays a role. True. And I remember the story of, who is the president who put people in the moon?
Kennedy.
Yeah, I think so. Like,
history is great.
Yeah, obviously. he went to NASA, and then he was, and then he saw like a janitor, and then he asked him like, "What do you do?" And the janitor answered, he said, I helped to put people on the moon.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's cool. Have you had anything that kind of challenged your ethics during medical things, or that you sort of felt with being done incorrectly?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's always like bad apples.
Yeah.
You know, in everywhere you are, all the time. But you just have to follow what your principle is. You just don't give in. And I have a story with some of the more unethical doctors, sort of like charge patients more for the drugs. And we have like a compassionate program for patients where the patients get like certain medication for free after they buy some medication, like one for one, one buy one, free one kind of thing, just to bring down the cost of the medication. But some doctors, they took advantage of the loophole of the system, and they never tell the patients that they're on the program, and they just charge patients for all the medication. So we have that kind of cases, but I came out with the idea to bring the system online so that it's more transparent to the patient. Yeah. The patients sign up themselves and things like that, and sort of like solve the problem. So I believe there is always a solution to a problem, and you don't give in to what you believe in. I mean, the patients are sick. I mean, they're on terminal illness, and why do you want to do that?
Yeah. So how did that like process even come to be? Like, how did the people at your bosses not realize that was going on?
Oh,
or how did you realize that was going on? Not
other people? I was on the ground. I mean, I started off as a sales rep.
Yeah.
So I go to hospitals to meet all the doctors, the pharmacies. I know what's happening on the ground because I see them on a day-to-day basis. But it's corporate work. From me to my MD, my managing director, I have my sales manager reporting to. He reports to national sales manager. National sales manager reports to business unit director. Then business unit director report to managing director. Just the gap of three people is enough to change the story. And there were a lot of fear even among people who know what's going on.
Yeah.
Because we are here. Yes, we and this was back in Roche. I mean, we innovate healthcare, we believe in patients, benefiting patients and things like that. But we are still a profitable organization.
Mm.
You still need to make sure revenue comes in and things like that. And there are people who are afraid that if they confronted the truth and try to solve the problem, it may offend the customers, which are the doctors, and they're not prescribing your products. And it can backfire. And I don't blame them for being afraid to act. But me being myself, because I was so small, I don't really give a shit about the job.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, like I told my idea to two people and they don't get what I was trying to say. Eventually, I got a chance to present it to my managing director and he got it. But I spent whole night just to draft a proposal because I realized that the first two couldn't understand what I was trying to say because they couldn't read my mind. So I was writing down, I was drawing out my mind for the whole, like, I didn't sleep that night. And I told myself, now this is the third time I'm going to tell somebody. And if this guy doesn't get it, right, which is my managing director, I will resign. I will not work under this kind of, you know. So fortunately, he get it, and yeah, it has brought about a good change in the company, and definitely for the patients.
Nice. Well, yeah. Congratulations. And
win for Bob
and everyone. So what's your general goal?
If you work in the healthcare industry, you have to have patients must be at your heart. Whatever you do, you must think of the patients. If you're not thinking for the patients, you shouldn't be in the healthcare industry. I just want to see the healthcare continue to advance. There's so much gap in our healthcare, even though we are now much better compared to maybe 50 to 100 years ago, but we still have no cure for a lot of things. Like, I mean, cancer is worse, but I just like to see patients live longer, and I would do everything I can just to achieve that.
By longer, do you mean everyone should reach sort of 80 to 90 or?
No. Those are like chronic disease. I think for diabetes, hypertension and all, it's pretty okay because it's quite advanced right now and the patients don't usually die because of diabetes and things like that. But for this kind of diseases, it's more of awareness, education.
Yeah.
Like the patients need to know. For example, at least for now, right? For diabetes, there is no cure, but the disease can be managed in a way that you will not die because of the disease. And some patients, a lot of patients in Malaysia, for example, they expect cure, like just like how you get fever and you take some pills and then you go away. So diabetes is not like that. And it is the patient has to understand that they are on a chronic disease. They have to be compliant in taking the medication. The lifestyle has to be good and things like that, so that they're okay. They don't drop out from treatment and things like that. That is the thing that I think for diabetes has to focus on, while the researchers and all are looking for cure for that disease. Cancer, on the other hand, is different. You know, like for breast cancer, if it's stage 4, I mean, on average, I don't know, like people survive for like 5 years.
Yeah.
If it's lung cancer, now probably like 1 year, 2 years. So definitely much more things to do in that field.
Okay. Period. So what do you think about the kind of end goals that some people are putting research into, like serious life extension and kind of trying to get people to live for hundreds of years and things?
I don't believe in that. I agree with what Steve Jobs said. You know, death is the greatest invention of all. Can you imagine you're living and you know that you're not going to die? You take your time.
Yeah.
You don't do what you want to do. And it's just, I don't know, you will live life so differently.
Yeah.
I think that death is, I don't know, I mean, it's a good invention, but how people die, I think everyone should be given enough time to do what they want to do.
Yeah, that's the problem, is in you kind of always want a bit more time, and like, I feel like it makes sense, but like, yeah, I only want to live like 80, 90 years, and so by then it's enough. But actually, like at that point, no one ever sort of really wants to die unless they've been in the hospital like for months on end with sort of just having a shit time, and there's clearly nothing better for them to do. But like, if you were still like just as healthy as you were when you were 20, at the point of 80, you're like, well, tomorrow I don't want to suddenly be able to like not go up the stairs or like not go to the toilet by myself. And every day you wouldn't think tomorrow is the day where I'll just die. That's fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's too long for me to be at the age to imagine what I would think. But I think that a lot of people, when they reach that age, human, they want to feel like they add value to wherever they are. And I think there are times where you reach a certain age, you just need to give the younger generation a chance.
Mm.
And it's time for you to step back and just relax.
That is like, because you can't stand up by yourself, or because you can't actually sort of think very fast, it's your body's failing you. But if your body never has to fail you, then why do you ever have to stop? But I read a really nice book called Replay by Ken Grimwood. It's about this guy that he lives to like 60 and he has a sudden heart attack. But he wakes up again as a 20-year-old, but himself like 40 years ago, but with all of his memories. So it's literally like he sort of loops back into his own body. And so like, but he starts doing this again and again. So he does like these different lives every time he comes back.
This is fiction, right?
Yeah, it's a fiction. Okay. It's not real, obviously. But it's quite interesting the way like you don't do the same things each time. It makes you really think about like, the choices you make. You just one thing slightly different one time and like it changes his
entire
thing. Just like the impact, and like that you only really have like one set of paths to take in your one life.
Yep.
But if you have multiple lives, you could do all these different things in like
the right
time. And it's just quite beautiful. It makes you think about like how to spend your time most wisely rather than just doing the one thing that's in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's a really good book. I'd recommend it.
To change the topic to couch surfing.
How did you get into couch surfing?
The very first couch surfing, unofficial couch surfing I did was I picked up a stranger, like a Japanese guy in the airport. That was 10 years ago. Because I never really have time to do it before. I focused so much of my life at work and things like that. I remember at the time I missed a train and I met this guy and then he was lost in the airport. And I spoke to him and I ended up invited him to my house to sleep at the couch. It was like an interesting story because he flew all the way here just to see... He's a baker, and then he admired a baker so much that he's a Japanese baker, invited by our ex-prime minister to come and open a store in Malaysia. It's called The Loaf. So he wants to meet him. So he flew all the way from Tokyo just to see him. And I met him in the airport. He was trying to get a ticket to the KL Central, but he couldn't do it because he couldn't speak English. But he could speak Mandarin because he was in Taiwan for 4 years, and I can speak Mandarin. I missed my train that day, and someone was tapping me, asking me to help him. And you know, I had a bad day because I missed my train, but I told him, I said, like, what do you want? And he said, like, oh, I want to get a ticket to the train ticket. And then I said, okay, you just have to go there. The counter is there. And I brought him to the counter. Then I realized why he didn't get his ticket, because the guy was in the toilet. So after that, he got his ticket. The train is here. I went into the train. Like, I didn't want to talk to anyone. It's not a good day. But he came in to the same train, and yeah. I was like, oh my God, he's coming again. And he approached me, and he was so polite, and he thanked me, and he wanted to, and he tell me why is he here for, and things like that. I didn't think so much that time, because you try to be careful with strangers. I did think like that at that time. And then I was the first one who got out of the train when I reached KL Central. And then I went up the escalator, and then something just stopped me. And then I was thinking, okay, maybe this guy really need my help. And I went down again. He was the last one who came out of the train. And I asked him, where are you going to stay tonight? And he showed me his guidebook. He said, here, it's Kuala Lumpur KTM Station Hotel. I said, I've been to that station. I lived here for a while. I never heard of that hotel before. I said, okay, you know what? Follow me. We take a taxi to my house. I'll take my car. I'll bring you to that hotel that you're talking about to make sure you got a place to stay tonight. So in the taxi, we talked some more. It was the second time in Malaysia. The first time he came to Malaysia, he got cheated by a taxi driver to go to Melaka.
Yeah.
He charged him like 1,000 ringgit. And then I found out that he was in the airport since morning. I met him like at 8 p.m. But he was in the morning in the airport. Nobody helped him. He got nothing to eat. He was hungry. Yeah. So I said, okay, you know what? Let's go for dinner. I brought him to Jalan Alor. Place I brought you.
Nice.
So we had dinner, and then he tell me why he's here for. And I said, oh, there is the loft here in Pavilion. So after the dinner, there was like 10 o'clock already. I dropped him at Pavilion. Then he went into the bakery store, and then he came out, and then he told me that, oh, that guy is not here. He's in Langkawi branch. And I said, and then he said, oh, but I have his card. So I said, call him. Then he said, oh, no. We're Japanese, we don't call stranger, you know, it's not polite. And I said, give me the card, I'm gonna call him. So I called that guy, and I told him that, look, this guy flew all the way from Japan just to see you. You better make sure you see him. And he didn't believe me. And then he asked me to pass the phone over to him. And then they spoke in Japanese. And then he invited him over to Langkawi. So I said, okay, then go. And he said, oh, he wants me to go with him. I said, no, it's fine. Langkawi is a small town. Nobody's gonna cheat your money. So, and then I told him that, you know what, it's late now. I don't have a room for you because I rented out both my rooms, but I have a couch. If you don't mind, you can sleep in my couch. And he was like, he was so thankful about it. And he ended up sleeping in my place. And next day I brought him to the care center to get a ticket to fly to Langkawi. He met the guy. They spent 4 hours together. He offered him a job, but he didn't take it. And then he came back and spent another night with me before he go to Singapore. And I told him that, you know, in my life, I never miss a train. That was the first night, and I met you.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's random. Yeah. And since then, you've got super into kitesurfing.
No, I didn't. Oh, yeah. I was busy and everything, but I only started recently, like, to really be active in kitesurfing. Yeah, it has been great.
What do you think makes you do it more? Is it just, like, the enjoyment of hosting people, or being able to get hosted afterwards? So it's...
No, I think couchsurfing is a way for me to help people. I went to the States for work and travel 2 times. The second time when I went to the States, it was not as smooth as the first time. First time, it was amazing. I spent 8,000 ringgit for the work and travel visa, and then I bring back 16,000 ringgit just by working at McDonald's. It was crazy. The second time, I quit my job after first day working there, and then I had a problem trying to get a job. And then I was struggling for, I think, 2 weeks or 2 months. I can't remember. I think probably 2 weeks in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I hate Seattle so much. It's always rainy, cloudy. Mm-hmm. I almost get depressed over there. And then I moved to my mom's friend's house in San Francisco. And that's when I felt like it's a paradise, you know, the sunlight and everything. And the reason why she opened up her home was because my mom sort of like kind of like hosted her when she was here. And that's when she opened a home for me. And after that, I moved to Virginia, and I stayed there for like 3 weeks. I stayed in the basement with family. Like that family, the guy is a nephew of my mentor here in Malaysia. So he's American, but he lives here for like, I don't know, more than 10 years. And I sort of, he like know my situation over there, and he arranged a place for me to stay. So I stay with the family. The guy is Micah, and his wife is Miho. His wife is Japanese. They have like two really cute daughters. I really miss them. And when I went to Virginia, somehow the tenant at the basement moved out. Mm. And then I stayed there for like 3 weeks. And as soon as I moved out, there was a new tenant came in. So I just felt so thankful with all the experience that I had when I was traveling, and I had such a hardship at that time. And somehow things just line up accordingly. Yeah. Like I told you, like I came in when the guy moved out, and then I, you know, a new tenant came in right after I moved out. And I can understand what the travelers are going through, and I just like to help them. I think helping people is a nice thing to do. It makes people happy. It makes me happy.
Mm.
And there are many ways you can help people.
Yeah.
You know, like I have a colleague who do street feeding. Like she goes to downtown and she feed the homeless. But you have to wake up and you have to stay late. Like you can only do that like midnight. So, you know, I think different people help people differently.
Yeah.
So like for me, I chose to do. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So I'd like to think that I'm a nice guy and I'm pretty generous.
Okay.
But compared to you, I feel like I'm a selfish, horrible guy that sort of isn't helpful for anyone, because you're pretty, amazing with like just how generous and nice you are. Like just the fact, like obviously giving me a spare room that I can just use whenever, and having a key to the house is cool. But like even on the first day, you're like, oh yeah, if you want to use my car, like these are my car keys. I'm like, the fuck? Like, I mean, I could be your shit driver. Do you not want to like check about these things? And you've been like great, just like picking me up and taking me places and things. Instead of there's being nice, and there's like the next level of nice, and you're definitely at the next level. And like, how did you get to that level? Is it like an active choice you make every day to be like, remember to like go one step further, or are you just naturally like, oh well, I'll just this is
no
how I should be?
Yeah, definitely not. I definitely don't do that. Like, I don't try to do that. I will only offer what I have. I don't give my car keys to you when I need a car. I only give it to you when I'm traveling, when I don't use the car. And it's more convenient for me to pass you my house key, because I don't have to come back and open the door for you and things like that. You have the key. You can go in and out anytime you want. How did I get to this? I told you just now, like, It's really about, I think, my parents, especially my mom. I mean, she's such a giver. There was a time of my life where I became a bit more selfish, and I kind of like stopped her for trying to give too much.
Yeah.
And I, you know, now I think back, I'm like, that was a terrible thing that I did, because she was trying to be happy, because for her, giving is happy. I mean, I can tell you like an example of what she did when I was studying. Of course, I didn't ask a lot because of the way she brought me up. I sort of like stayed quite far away from my college, but it's not like too far, but it's not easy for you to walk.
Mm.
So I wanted to have a bicycle. So I asked for a bicycle from her, and then she said, no, it's too dangerous, you know, because you know how the KL people drive here. And then I said, okay, maybe a motorcycle. And she said, no, it's still too dangerous. So she ended up gave me a car. It's like a 30,000 ringgit car, because she said, oh, there's a car here, nobody use it, and you can take it. So she sent me the car. But what she did was, at the same time, she gave a 70,000 ringgit car to a pastor's daughter.
Yeah.
She just gave away like that. And at that time I was thinking, okay, is she your daughter or I'm your son, you know, the kind of thing. Like, but now I'm thankful because of the way she brought me up. She doesn't spoil me. Like, I don't expect people to be nice to me, or I don't expect, you know, nice things to come to me. But I like to give also because of the way she brought me up. Like, I wasn't brought up in like a wealthy or rich family, but we have enough. And she always told me that you just need to have enough and the rest you just give to people. And she always say, the more you give, the more you receive. And I don't really understand all these things until recently I do all these things. And I find that I became much more happy.
Yeah.
Maybe the things that I get back is not material things or whatever, but you get so much happiness in your life.
Yeah.
And you feel so much peace. You become more productive and things like that. And I also realized that giving is like a privilege for two reasons. Number one, you can only give what you have, right? So if you can give somebody something, that means you're more privileged than somebody, yeah. right? And that could mean even a smile. Like sometimes you see some people like they have a bad day. They yeah. can't even smile. But you can yeah, smile and you give him a smile and he make his day. And then, you know, that's why you're more privileged than him, right? And the second thing is, the second reason why it is a privilege is you can only give when the other party is willing to receive, you know? The world has become so, I don't know, so crazy that whenever someone is nice to you, you think that, okay, maybe this guy...
Yeah, I want something else.
Yeah. Agenda. So, but if someone just, okay, thank you, it's a privilege because they allowed you to give. That's my thinking.
Cool, yeah, it's really nice. I look on it.
And it makes you feel so much more grateful in life because you realize that you actually have a lot to give. You are in a good, better position than a lot of people because you're able to give. Even a smile is a gift, you know, because you're happy.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good point, isn't it? Just going around like your normal life just definitely makes you happier just choosing to be happy in the moment, if you get me, as in when something comes your way that could make you unhappy and you go, I'm not going to let this make me be unhappy.
Yeah.
You feel extra happy just because you decided that. Like, I remember when I was sort of 17 or 18, like I got a parking ticket this one day and it pissed me off and like I felt like I'd been done wrong because I'd parked there for like 5 minutes and it was super annoying. And like, I lost like 100 quid or whatever. And it wasn't like the end of the world, but it ruined the rest of my day.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, my friend was like, oh, you can park here because he lived in the city. I didn't know it. And I was like, okay, cool. And so we went for lunch, came back and I had another parking ticket. And I was like, oh, fucking hell. Like, and like, so it was mostly his fault. But then I was like, okay, well, I should have listened to him. It's my car. And I just sort of, just because I had such a bad day yesterday, I just couldn't be arsed with having another bad day. And I just chose, you know what? I just don't care about this. This is fine. I'm going to have a good day the rest of the day.
Yeah.
I'm going to be able to see my friend otherwise. But I then had like a much better day. Just because I'd chosen to not be pissed off, I was like extra happy. I felt like even more sort of like in the moment and like happy that I wasn't unhappy
exactly
the whole time.
I think that is a good point. Like for me, shit's always happened.
Yeah.
And when it happens, I just say, okay, I learned it. The next time I won't do this again. And in fact, I would tell myself, I'm so happy that I learned the new things today.
Yeah.
And it's not going to repeat. So then you just move on with your life. And you, like what you say, you'll be happier.
Yeah. If you ever watched Kung Fu Panda, there's like the phrase that his master teaches him, like, yesterday is history.
Yeah.
Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That's why we call it the present.
Yeah.
Yep. You ruined the punchline there.
I'm sorry.
It's a good quote though. And
yeah.
It means like to value what you have right now and don't worry so much.
Yeah. Then I'm going to show you a quote. Dalai Lama, when asked what surprised him the most about humanity, he answered, man, because he sacrifices his health in order to make money. Then he sacrifices his money to recuperate his health. And then he is so anxious about the future that he does not enjoy the present. The result being that he does not live in the present or the future. He lives as if he's never going to die and then dies. Having never really lived.
Oh, wow.
It's very powerful. Like,
yeah.
He's a wise guy.
Super wise. Cool. That's like, maybe I'll come back to that to end the podcast.
Sure. Something
to think about. Oh, yeah. You did a meditation retreat, didn't you? How was that?
Yeah, I did.
What's it called? The Vipassana?
Vipassana meditation for 10 days.
So that's where you're like completely silent and you don't talk to anyone for 10 days.
You don't talk to anyone for 10 days.
Okay.
No.
Do they do like a pre-day where they kind of warm you up to it?
No.
Like, okay, this is what you're going to think about. It's like a drill.
No.
You just sort of walk in, they take your phone and everything.
Yes.
And you just sit in a room.
Yes. They give you like a room to yourself.
Yeah.
Phone is taken, everything, no book, nothing. Yeah, there's no, but the first two days are, were really tough.
So it's like an empty room.
Empty room, yeah.
Okay.
It's just a bed. It's like a simple bed.
And you don't see anyone at all, or do you see
No, you see, like, but you can't have eye contact with them.
Okay.
Yeah, you...
It sounds a bit like isolation treatment in prison
is.
Kind of thing. Like...
No,
you could like get some hookers and drugs and have
Sorry.
The same dream.
The room is just like for you to sleep, but
yeah.
when you meditate, it's in a hall.
Okay,
so you meditate
do the other
with
people. Do other people speak then, and they
no.
say like, okay,
you can only you're only allowed to speak to the.
So how do you know like where to sit and like what's going on?
Okay.
How do you order your food?
No,
Sorry, one thing at a time.
Okay, so what happened is that you have like. Your rooms, that's for
yeah.
you to sleep. So they sort of like assign where you sleep.
Yeah.
And then you have your cushion for you to meditate in the hall. So you know which one is your cushion.
Yeah.
So you don't sit on somebody else's
okay.
cushion. And then there's a hall for food. So you
yeah.
go to the hall and then you take a tray. And then there are people who serve. They serve you like, you know, one
yeah.
scoop of everything. And then you just eat.
Cool.
But you don't talk to the students.
You spend the entire time being like, I could speak. Or did you?
No.
Because like, I feel like, you know, when you're like on a cliff, you're always like, oh, I could jump. Like, do you feel like the entire time, like, oh, maybe this like this huge noise is going to burst out of my mouth by accident or something?
No, but I had to say that I cheated on
yeah.
probably the ninth day or something.
What?
I started to speak to my friend, but
yeah.
the first...
Was that like by accident? You just sort of randomly like said something and you're like, oh, shit.
No, I just like, I just decided to like, hey. Like, and then we started talking, but it was illegal, so we had to go into the room and, you know,
right.
whisper instead of talk.
Did it feel good?
Yeah, it was okay, but
what did you say? Did you like, oh, I've been thinking about this or what?
Yeah, I just wanted to I was trying to understand like what was his experience, because
yeah,
you know, I just want to know that. That's it.
Yeah, sure.
But it was an interesting experience, because I always wanted to learn about meditation, because I read so much about it, I heard so much about it, you know, the relaxation, it relaxes your mind and things like that. But when I go to the camp,
yeah,
it's completely different from what I imagined.
Yeah.
It's not an easy work. It's
yes.
hard work.
Yeah. 10 minutes is hard.
Yeah. No, because you, I mean,
10 days. What?
10 days, you wake up at 4. And you start meditating for 2 hours, and then you have breakfast, and then you meditate again. So basically, you meditate for 10 hours a day, for
wow.
10 days. So there's like 100 hours of meditation.
That's a lot.
So
yeah.
that's why I say it's hard. But if you
that's
just use the technique, like for now, I don't meditate for spiritual reason, but sometimes when I'm stressed or I know the day is going to be tough, you know, I just take like maybe 5 to 10 minutes just to do a quick meditations, and it
yeah.
really helps my mind to relax.
Yeah, I've been getting into meditation a lot, and trying
yeah.
to do it every morning now. But
yeah, I definitely recommend a camp, because you will really learn how to meditate properly, because you can watch YouTube and things like that to try to learn it, but it's different, you know, it's
that.
Really different.
Cool. Yeah, it's on my life things to do at some point. It sounds like really mentally challenging, but it seems stupid that I can't take 10 days to try and just challenge my entire mental aspect.
I think there
yeah.
are a lot of meditations.
Did many people drop out?
I did see like a few of them. Not a lot. Maybe like one or two.
Okay, out of how many people join each time?
150.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Still so crazy.
I was trying to go back again, but I thought maybe not, because the meditation
yeah.
is more of a technique, which I think I've got it, but you know, you don't know. I don't know.
Do you have any favorite memories from a child, or any like really stand out memories?
Whoa.
So
from a child.
Could be like a really bad thing that happened, but like something that's just like
when I was a child.
Yeah, something that's like ingrained in your mind
because I put on lotion. So I grew up with my dad's sister. I can only speak Labit, and I thought she was my mom.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
and yeah. I mean, I grew up with her, and then so my mom got worried about me not recognizing her as a real mom. So she decided to bring me back to her town and then put me in a Chinese school. So that's when I started to learn Mandarin. It took me like, she was so worried about me, looking at me from the outside of the class.
Yeah.
And she said it took me just 2 weeks to
what?
Learn Mandarin. I don't know, you know?
Wow.
Mothers. But ever since then, I lost my Kelabit. Now I don't speak Kelabit anymore. I can understand the basics.
Yeah.
But I don't speak Kelabit anymore. I speak English with my dad, Mandarin with my mom. But I told all my friends I have two mothers.
Yeah.
Like, one is here and another one is in another town. Up to the age of 12, I think. 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's when I realized that, okay, she is my real mom, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I still...
That's funny.
Yeah, I still care about my dad's sister. I call her my godmom. And then the photo, you know, the graduation photo,
yeah.
You see? So the one seated, that's her. So even my mom, you know, she makes sure that when I go back to hometown, I go and visit her. I mean,
yeah,
she's old, so I buy things for her, you know, because she wants me to be grateful for her, because she sort of like took care of me for the first 4 years of my life. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you want to ask me?
I think one of the things that I've always wanted to do is to learn programming.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like what I'm doing right now is more of like doing things that I will always want to do, and that also make me feel so much happier.
Yeah.
And programming is one of them. And yeah, but I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's not an easy path to start with.
No.
Yeah?
No, it's definitely kind of hard.
Yeah.
So yeah, do you want advice on like
how to start?
Because your background is not programming, right?
No.
So it's kind of interesting how you got into programming.
So I started with just Code Academy.
Oh,
it's like there's three resources for just learning like the super basics of things.
Okay.
And from that, I did a few. I could go into like Code Wars, which is another website that sort of has just challenges for you from the super basic to like the super hard.
Okay.
You just can do like them every day.
Right.
If you try and just do like one, two of these little challenges, then you just start building up. And like every time you do a new one, you kind of have to Google certain syntax and things. You kind of learn how to think more in programming, and then but you need to do like the basics like that for sort of maybe 2 or 3 months. I then did like a boot camp. But
yeah.
if you're good at self-learning, you can do like courses over soon.
Yeah.
The older you get, it is just jumping into being a complete junior, because you can't just jump into, so if you get to being like a really high level manager, you can kind of change industry but still not go right to the bottom of the ladder maybe. But in a programming, when you start, you'll be shit.
Yep.
You can't demand a good job.
Yep.
You have to be the bottom level programmer.
Yep.
And do like an internship or whatever. So it takes some humility to be willing to just go down to the bottom again and just be a complete junior. But if you're willing to take a year out and just do like a 3 month boot camp and do like a basic junior level job, then by the end of it, you'll know a lot more about the world you're interacting with.
Okay.
And you can potentially then go back into interviewing before. We just know, like, have a way more useful skill.
Yeah.
That just everything is going on otherwise, which would be good, I think. So yeah, I would recommend it. And lastly, do you have any amazing books that you've read that have shaped you?
It's kind of cliche, but the book that really changed my life is this book. It's called, I'm sure you know it, by Stephen Covey, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Yeah. In fact, I never read that book.
Yeah.
I mean, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I never read that one. I read the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teenager by the Sun.
Oh.
Yeah, when I was 16 years old.
That one.
Yeah, it's they're basically the same, talk about the same thing, but he just used the example for like teenager to try to get better understanding of what habits are.
It's really funny.
Yeah, that book changed my life because I was never a good student, I would say. Student. We have like public exam in Malaysia when we are 12,
mm-hmm.
15, and 17.
Yeah.
So for my public exam at age of 12, I only get 1 A.
Yeah.
15, 1 out of 6, right? And then 15, I got 2 out of 7, I think.
Yeah.
And so I was never considered like a potential guy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I decided to go to a boarding school when I turned 16 because my brother went to college. So I was lonely at home. I asked my mom to send me to the boarding school. So she sent me together with my two friends. And these two friends, they were good students. They have like 5 A's out of 7.
Yeah.
And then so the principal in that school didn't want to accept me to be in the science class, because in Asia, you know, like parents want the kids to be in the science class, that kind of thing. So my mom was telling him that my son he's smart, but he's just naughty. He mixed with the wrong friends and things like that. But you give him a chance, he will be good. So then the principal said, okay, I'll give him a chance, but with two conditions. Number one, he has the two friends, the good student, they're supposed to go into the A class.
Yeah.
Because of me, they go to C class. Because the principal wants them to influence me.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the second thing is, I have to stay with that one of the friend, because the other one is a girl. It's like
one guy.
So I have to stay with the other guy in a room in the hostel.
Wow.
And you know what he did? He wakes up every day 4 a.m. in the morning and he study.
Cool.
He turns on the light. He don't give a shit about you. You know, this you know, the real genius people, they have like terrible social skill.
Yeah.
And then they just wake up and turn on the light and he starts studying. And you know what happened? Wow. Eventually I followed.
Yeah.
And I only pick up reading at the age 16. Before that, I never read. Oh. And that was one of the first books that I read, 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teenagers, and it changed my life.
Okay.
You know, the 6 habits and the 7 habits, of course, the 7 habits is sharpening your soul.
Yeah.
And because of that 7 habit, after that, I just keep reading books and keep watching like TED Talk
or,
you know, other things, just keep improving myself. And that was the turning point of my life. And of course, we became good friends after that. You know, he learned a lot about social skill with me.
Yeah.
And I became more hardworking and then learned how to study and get good grades. At the end of my 2 years with him, and my public school, 17 years old, I got 7 A's out of 9 subjects.
Nice.
Yeah.
Five.
Whoa. And he got 9 A's. Two of them got 9 A's. And when we went back to my town, right?
Yeah.
I grew up in a small town. It's like a fisherman, businessman town.
Yeah.
Nobody was interested in him. Everybody was asking me, how did I get my 7 A's?
Yeah.
Because nobody expected that.
Yeah.
You know?
So life tip, do you really shit me until like the last set of exams that surprise people and they'll remember.
Yeah. In fact, I even went into the news, you know, like
what?
No, seriously, because my mom, she was kind of like a representative in the political party in that town. So there was one time when there was one event when they were giving out, you know, like excellent award to the student.
Yeah.
So when they gave me the award, right, she bought like a bouquet of flower for me. So they took the photo. So my mom know the journalist, and then so she wrote about how the politician's son got good result and things like that. So I think my mom still have that.
Cool.
That newspaper cutting.
Yeah, that's really fun.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
I just think that it would be great if everyone in this world just want to give a little bit more.
Mm.
I mean, I would really like to see that one day, especially the new generation. I mean, you can imagine like how if every employee want to give a little bit more, a little extra mile in their work, and how every employer want to give a little bit more compensation and bonus.
Yeah,
and
that,
the world will be much better.
And
I think
you should get so much more from
everyone
around you and
be
instantly more friends with everyone.
Exactly. And I think that's the only thing that I would really want to encourage people to do. Just start to give, and you are always more privileged compared to someone else. You know, like what I told you, even a smile is a gift.
Yeah. Ooh. Okay. Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And thanks for having me and everything.
Thanks for having me.
So that was my interview with Bob. Like I said, he is a really great guy, and he hosted me and my friend in his new home for a whole month out of the blue, and never really had an issue with anything. I genuinely feel like he had a profound effect on how I want to live my life, and his encouragement to do things like Vipassana meditation and to share more have completely changed my mindset and made me a happier and nicer person to be around, I think. So this podcast was actually recorded last year, and since then, like just last week, I finished completing a 10-day silent meditation retreat called Vipassana that Bob recommended me to go and do. So that was possibly one of the best experiences of my life, and I will definitely do a full episode on these retreats and what they do to your brain. And I guess a lot of the things that Bob talks about relating to how to live a happier life suddenly seem a lot more obvious to me. And things like the story I told about Bob's new kitchen that I didn't really appreciate at the time makes so much more sense now. So I'll try and break things down in my top tips for you. Number one, happiness can be derived through generosity. Now, this is kind of a difficult concept to grasp, and initially practicing it when you're brought up in a world where you're taught to think for yourself and kind of prioritize your own wants first makes it quite difficult. But when you can start deriving happiness from making others happy, your life will truly change. When you think of things from other people's perspectives instead of your own perspective, you really unlock a whole extra dimension of happiness that never really existed before, and it suddenly becomes remarkably easy just to enjoy each day instead of going through life selfishly trying to have more for yourself or feeling owed stuff or victimized when you don't get as much as others do, instead of just feeling happy that other people are doing well. So this also makes you a much nicer person to be around, and then other people start doing nice things for you, and your life and relationships get a whole lot better. So Bob thinks that the ability to be generous should be considered a privilege in itself that you shouldn't take for granted and try and use at all times. The first point about this is the fact that if you can give anything, that is a privilege. So even a smile is a privilege that you are happy right now. Giving anything of value is a privilege that you have something of value. And then point two was that being able to give to others because they are open to receive is also a privilege. Like, not everyone in life is ready to receive help or advice or any form of gifts from you. So when people are open to generosity, you can be grateful that you're able to improve their day and help them. And then to conclude with his biggest philosophy, having what you need is enough, and having more is awesome because you get to share and give to others and you can be even happier. Number two. Happiness through living in the moment and basically just deciding to be happy. So don't let your expectations of what you want control your happiness. And when shit things happen, just accept them and move on without being dragged into unhappiness. So like Bob in his new kitchen or me in my parking ticket, if you just accept reality as it is now, straight away, you can continue to be happy and have good relationships with those around you. If you kick and scream like a child, resisting acceptance of this new fate that has befallen you, and then blaming those around you or shouting at people, you're just being stupid. And you have to accept this new situation eventually, so you may as well just accept it now and stop wasting time. And yeah, to summarize, if a problem arises and you let that make you unhappy and you get angry or sad, instead of having one problem, you create many more problems for yourself, and you waste your own time being unhappy. And you waste time with those around you being addicted to them. And life is simply too short to waste with this, so just don't, basically. And then life becomes much better. And as a bonus, when you observe the fact that you could be unhappy right now, but you've decided not to be, you feel even happier because you're aware of how much crap you're avoiding. And life is just super great. Number three, stay true to your beliefs. When something makes you feel awkward and you feel like it can't be changed or those around you aren't doing anything about it, don't just carry on and leave the thing. Like, have the balls to stick your neck out and risk it. So Bob saved patients money and impressed his bosses ultimately by being the only one willing to tell them about the issues going on with the doctors stealing money from the patients. He risked being not understood or losing sales of the product for his company by the doctors no longer using their products, but he stood up for his belief and the patients, and then everything worked out. So I think we all have times when our moral beliefs are challenged, and examples like this are a great reason to have faith in ourselves instead of just following the crowd. And now onto books. So I firstly recommended Replay by Ken Grimwood, a tale of a man who is reborn several times into the same body as a teenager. And this provides a really good perspective on the way someone can choose to live a life. And I find it just a really beautiful tale of the past and decisions we take in life and how they affect us and what really matters in our search for happiness. 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens by Sean Covey. So Sean is the son of Stephen Covey, who wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And this book is just an interpretation of those principles in a way that a teenager can apply them to their own life, or a parent or a grandparent can help them. And both books are really excellent reads, apparently, for anyone who wants to do more with their lives and be happy.